Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the radio.com app today.
Mr. Trump has magic about him.
This is the greatest country in the world, but we do have some really stupid people.
How can I describe our leaders better than the word stupid?
This guy has magic coming out his ears.
This is the most unethical sham.
So in the words of my late friend Aretha Franklin, show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I've never known a guy more talented at untangling politics so that anyone can understand.
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
All right, as we get started here this afternoon, it looks like the FBI has a briefing on the Capitol Hill riot from last week. We're going to air a portion of that. We'll find out what we can about some of the arrests. It's so funny because in the era of Trump, and this has happened so many times, I have plans and how we're going to frame the show and do the show. And I tell Dave, here's what we're going to do for the open. It's a little trickier just because I'm at home and he's in the studio. If I was there in the studio, I can handle a lot of the audio and putting it in order by myself. But then I tell Dave we're going to do this, and now everything's blown up because of the FBI briefing. But let me start, Dave, with the audio of the guy who is the attorney for one of the dudes that was arrested last week. And then I say dudes affectionately because this was the dude. Well, there's the guy that was behind Pelosi's desk, and then there was the other guy that was just kind of waving. I think he was the Confederate flag guy. I got to check on that. But here, I have to play this because Dan Eckert is the guy who's the attorney. There's another attorney that's standing by him, and the writer guy from last week is standing. He's got a mask on. He's right behind his lawyers, and there's just this brief little media event where they're, you know, basically explaining that I think they say that he pleaded not guilty. You know, he was in court. Here's what it sounded like.
Part of what you have to, you know, factor into is, again, you just have to drill down on what actually happened. You have a photograph of our client, you know, in a building, you know, unauthorized to be there with, you know, what appears to be a podium or a lectern. I'm not exactly sure which one it is called, but that's what we have.
Obviously, that presents problems for you as a defense attorney in that you have your client in the building at the time of the break-in.
I don't know how to else explain that, but yeah, that would be a problem. I'm not a magician, and neither is Mr. Bigney. So yeah, we've got a photograph of our client who appears to be inside the federal building or inside the Capitol with the government property.
That's right. He's the guy who was carrying out the lectern, Nancy Pelosi's lectern. And, you know, he's just caught on camera. And the attorney, I love that because there's always these, you know, lawyers that get out there with the media and they claim that their client is innocent. We're going to insist that there is a misrepresentation once the facts. That's the thing that I think they go to media training for, this, like coaches and college athletes and people like that. You know, once all the facts are in, my client, Adam Johnson, even though he was caught red-handed, and there are multiple pictures and videos of him carrying the lectern, he's not guilty. This guy, I got to give him credit. He's like, yeah, I don't have a magic trick. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to work out. We're going to, you know, hope for leniency. All right, so we are expecting a briefing on the Capitol Hill riot, and I have Senator Blunt coming up this afternoon as well. But let me start just a little bit with vaccines. Because one of the complaints I suppose I've had for the past couple of months where we haven't been focusing on the coronavirus is, and I remember saying this at the beginning of the presidential race in the summer. Well, I wasn't the beginning of the presidential race, but once we had the nominees and it was pretty clear where we were heading, and Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris and stuff like that. Hey, let's ask, instead of just, you know, talking about all the crazy stuff that's going on, let's maybe ask each of these candidates what they're going to do with the rollout of the vaccine. And I don't know if you've noticed, but India, the nation of India, is actually more effective right now, seemingly, than this country when it comes to the vaccine. And it's a little confusing. So the CDC is changing this a little bit. But let me play Ron DeSantis down in Florida. I think this has been a mystery to a lot of people from the start. Because, and I know that healthcare workers are on the front lines and there are people in nursing homes. But how about giving the vaccine to the people who are most vulnerable? People over 65 in particular. Here, well, by the way, that's what Ron DeSantis has been doing down in Florida. But here's what he said today.
Florida has made the decision to put seniors first when it comes to the general population. And most states, in fact, almost all states, but a handful, made other choices. I think it's interesting that there is a report this morning that HHS is now going to tell states basically do what Florida's doing, focus on that 65 and up population. The initial CDC recommendation, we didn't follow it because it would have allowed a 20-year-old healthy worker to get a vaccine before a 74-year-old grandmother or grandparent. That does not recognize how this virus has affected elderly people.
It never made any sense whatsoever. So now the administration, and we have a new administration taking over next week, they're going to encourage the states to widen the access to COVID-19 vaccines. Health officials today will push states to expand the shots availability to anyone older than 65, regardless of underlying conditions that might put them at greater risk of severe disease, and anyone younger than 65 with such a condition. And that's not the only change. The U.S. will also no longer hold back second doses of the vaccine in order to make more shots available immediately, according to the Surgeon General. We have enough in reserve that we can start pushing those doses out there. I still think there's a lot of questions here in Missouri with how this is working. I haven't even really inquired about it because I know that I'm way, way down on the list. But I've asked a few people who might be, you know, scheduled to get this shot a little sooner, and I don't think people have a lot of information. The other aspect of this is the, you know, the side effects of the vaccine itself. And I'm going to try to carve in a little time here this afternoon to talk about that because I think people might want to chime in on that. And some of you out there either have personal experience or, you know, you've talked to people who have had some reactions to the vaccine. All right, here's what we got going here as we get moving the app throughout this afternoon. We are expecting an FBI briefing on the situation from last week. I'm not exactly sure. That caught me off guard. So I'm going to try to get to that. We have Senator Blunt standing by. I was going to try to chat with Missouri Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz of Franklin County. He's got a bill. He was actually scheduled a week ago tomorrow before everything happened on Capitol Hill because he's trying to increase the gas tax by 2 cents for 5 years. And we can talk to Dave a little bit about everything else that's going on in Jefferson City. And you know what today is the anniversary of, which is an epic, not only television show, but a point in history in this country, in television history, that was a cultural milestone for sure. 50 years ago today, January 12th, 1971, it was the first episode of All in the Family. And Robert Thompson, who has this great gig, he teaches television and pop culture at Syracuse University. He's always great to weigh in on these things. One of the questions we'll ask him is, I wonder if, and maybe I'm answering myself right here in just the rhetorical question, could that show even air on network television today? I think there'd be some questions about that. And I remembered watching the live versions of All in the Family from, I think it was 2019, where you had the updated cast and they took the scripts from 1973, I think, in this particular episode. They've done it a couple of times, but when you hear the language, it's rather jarring compared to what we're used to today on television. And the other thing that's sort of interesting to me, just because I'm a Diet Coke addict, that's the aluminum can shortage that's out there. It's real, actually, and it's frightening. It's the crisis that nobody's talking about, and we may have a little fun with that, but it is serious. We'll talk about it in the next hour on KMOX. I think the FBI is going to do a briefing. We'll take a break. We'll see what happens with that. If not, we got Senator Blunt standing by. It's all coming up on KMOX. The FBI is holding a briefing that just started. This is Stephen D'Antuono, and he's giving an update on the Capitol Hill riot from last week from the Department of Justice. We're going to join it live.
Multiple individuals who took part in the destruction. In 6 days, we have opened over 160 case files, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. The significance of this investigation is not lost on us. This is a 24/7 full bore extensive operation into what happened that day. We cannot do our job without the help of the American people. Since our call for tips, videos, and pictures, we have received more than 100,000 pieces of digital media, which is absolutely fantastic. And we are scouring every one for investigative and intelligence leads. We continue to ask for more. If you have information, contact 1-800-CALL-FBI or submit photos and videos to fbi.gov/US Capitol, and that's Capitol with an O. I want to stress that the FBI has a long memory and a broad reach. Agents and our partners are on the streets investigating leads not only here in the D.C. area, but also across the country through the FBI's 56 field offices. So even, like I've said before, so even if you've left D.C., agents from our local field offices will be knocking on your door if we find out that you are part of the criminal activity at the Capitol. But before we do this, this is your opportunity to come forward, as several individuals who were involved in Wednesday's riots have done, to volunteer about their participation. In the weeks leading up to the January 6th rally, the FBI worked internally with every FBI field office to ensure they were looking for that we were looking for any intelligence that may have developed about potential violence during the rally on January 6th. We developed some intelligence that a number of individuals were planning to travel to the D.C. area with intentions to cause violence. We immediately shared that information, and action was taken, as demonstrated by the arrest of Enrique Tarrio by the Metropolitan Police Department the night before the rally. Other individuals were identified in other parts of the country, and the travel subsequently disrupted. The FBI receives enormous amounts of information and intelligence, and our job is to determine the credibility and viability of it under the laws and policies that govern FBI investigations. We have to separate the aspirational from the intentional and determine which of the individuals saying despicable things on the internet are just practicing keyboard bravado or they actually have the intent to do harm. In the latter, we work diligently to identify them and prevent them from doing so. As offensive as a statement can be, the FBI cannot open an investigation without a threat of violence or alleged criminal activity. However, when that language does turn to a call of violence or criminal activity, the FBI is able to undertake investigative action. And in this case, we had no indication information was linked to any specific person, but this is a matter of an online discussion. This information was immediately disseminated through a written product and briefed through our command post operations to all levels of law enforcement. Part and parcel of our investigation into violent actors is the fact that we continue to gather intelligence that will aid in our ability to disrupt possible future violent activity. Suffice it to say, we are leveraging our relationships with federal, state, and local law enforcement partners, using our tools at our disposal to find and bring everyone involved in last week's criminal activity to justice. I'm now going to turn over to Acting U.S. Attorney Michael Sherman.
All right. Thank you, Steve. I think I mentioned this before a few days ago that, just to begin, I think the scope and scale of this investigation in these cases are really unprecedented, not only in FBI history, but probably DOJ history, in which essentially the Capitol grounds outside and inside are essentially a crime scene, and a scale in which we have literally thousands of potential witnesses and a scenario in which we're going to have, I believe, hundreds of criminal cases, both filed with our local courts, the Superior Court, and through the federal court system. So just to frame things, the enormity of this investigation is going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort, and this is not going to be solved overnight. It's not going to be solved within the coming weeks. It's not going to be solved within the coming months. This is going to be a long-term investigation, and rest assured, the Bureau, the Department of Justice, all the U.S. attorneys across the United States that are assisting these investigations, everyone is in for the long haul. So that being said, let's turn to the numbers that Steve referenced and the numbers are going to geometrically increase. So as we sit here now, literally days after this event happened, we have already opened more than 170 subject files, meaning these individuals have been identified as potential persons that committed crimes on the Capitol grounds, inside and outside. So of those 170 cases that have already been opened, and I anticipate that's going to grow to the hundreds in the next coming weeks, we've already charged over 70 cases. And again, that number, I suspect, is going to grow into the hundreds. So what are the types of cases we initially charged? And I think there's some misconceptions, and I want to clarify some of those misconceptions, because given the enormity of the actors we saw both inside and outside the Capitol, the range of criminal conduct is really, I think, again, unmatched in any type of scenario that we've seen the FBI or the DOJ. We're looking at everything from simple trespass to theft of mail to theft of digital devices with inside the Capitol to assault on local officers, federal officers both outside and inside the Capitol, to the theft of potential national security information or national defense information, to felony murder, and even civil rights excessive force investigations. So just the gamut of cases and criminal conduct we're looking at is really mind-blowing. And that has really put an enormous amount of work on the plate of the FBI and field office throughout the entire United States. So let's look at those initial cases. And again, I want to clarify some misconceptions. When criminal conduct occurs, we try to obviously charge people as soon as possible. So the way, looking just at the federal system, we'll try to do that via criminal complaint. So when these actors left the Capitol, these individuals, these defendants, obviously the impetus, the marching orders by federal law enforcement was to find, fix, and charge these individuals as fast as possible. So the prosecutors from the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, we look for the most simple charge we could file as quick as possible. So therefore, the initial charges filed in these cases, a lot of them were misdemeanors. They were trespass cases. However, those cases were opened on those initial charges. We also had several firearms charges. We also had several felony charges that were open with assault and battery, illegal felonious possession of weapons. However, I want to clarify a misconception. This is only the beginning. So after these criminal charges are filed via criminal complaints, that allows us, that allows law enforcement across the United States to arrest people from Dallas to Arkansas to Nashville to Cleveland to Jacksonville. That's what's happened over the past several days. It's really quite incredible. Now, after those charges are filed, then we have the ability to then indict these individuals on more significant charges. And that's exactly what has happened. For example, yesterday, again, only days after this event happened, we had the grand jury in the District of Columbia up. It was booked throughout the entire day. And for several hour upon hour, prosecutors in our office presented felony cases, significant felony cases related to civil disorder, related to the possession of destructive devices, related to the possession of semi-automatic weapons that are illegal to possess in the district. So again, I just want to clarify that the initial charges we're filing, some of these misdemeanors, these are only the beginning. This is not the end. So what are we looking at downstream here? So in terms of what we're looking at is the initial charges everyone's familiar with, the zip tie guys, the Munchels, and the Brocks that were arrested on the House floor with zip ties rifling through the House floor. People are familiar with online. They see the Barnetts and Johnsons who were literally rifling through Pelosi's office and stealing items, stealing materials, mail, and sometimes even personal mementos. So those are the cases the public's familiar with. They're familiar with those cases because of social media. But what the public isn't familiar with is that the FBI, working with the U.S. Attorney's offices across the country, and the crux of those being in D.C., we're looking at significant felony cases tied to sedition and conspiracy. Just yesterday, our office organized a strike force of very senior national security prosecutors and public corruption prosecutors. Their only marching orders from me are to build seditious and conspiracy charges related to the most heinous acts that occurred in the Capitol. And these are significant charges that have felonies with prison terms of up to 20 years. In addition to that, we're looking and taking a priority with cases in which weapons were involved, and cases in which destructive devices were involved. As people know through news reports, there were pipe bombs found outside the Capitol. The ATF is working on that. Metro Police is working on that. FBI is working on that to find that individual or individuals who planted those devices. So in addition to just those rogue cases we're looking at, we're going to focus on the most significant charges as a deterrent, because regardless of if it was just a trespass in the Capitol or if someone planted a pipe bomb, you will be charged and you will be found. In addition to that, we've also focused on an emphasis on assaults and batteries on police officers, both federal officers and local MPD officers that were assaulted. And as the days go on, there's going to be more social media, and people will recognize that in some instances, MPD and Capitol Police were in open-handed combat with some of these persons inside the Capitol, where tear gas was used on the Capitol Police and federal officers, and they were also used against some of these rioters. So the picture is going to build. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what happened within the Capitol, and it's going to come into laser focus, I think, over the next weeks and days. And I think people are going to be shocked with some of the egregious contact that happened within the Capitol. The third area emphasis that our office is also focusing on is we set up a strike force to focus on assaults on the media. Some people aren't familiar that some of those rioters specifically targeted members of the media and assaulted them. So we have assigned specific prosecutors in our office to focus on those cases as well. And I'm naming all these different strike forces to just emphasize, regardless of who the victim was, regardless of who the perpetrator was, we're treating all of these cases equally. Thank you very much.
We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. The first question is from Pete Williams.
So I'm gonna stick here with some questions here for the DOJ, and they're doing it obviously virtually. There's nobody in that room. Let's see what the question is.
Did the FBI gather before the assault on the Capitol about the potential for violence, and how did it share it, and did it share it to the Capitol Police?
We received a lot of intelligence, like I said in my statement, a lot of intelligence and information through all different means. Be it through social media or through CHS's, sources. And then we have a sharing mechanism with JTTFs. Across the country, we have Joint Terrorism Task Forces. And in this city, in D.C., we have a very robust JTTF. And in that, we have Capitol Police, Park Police, MPD, and all the other federal law enforcement partners. We shared intelligence through the JTTF model, and we also shared it through our command post structure, and then also through other means of they have access to our information readily available because they have access to our systems. So all that information was shared with our partners, and then we went from there.
The next question is from Evan Perez from CNN. Please go ahead.
Wondering if you could tell us perhaps if you found any indication so far to indicate that there was some level of planning and coordination for these people to go into the Capitol and carry out this attack rather than just a spontaneous mob that got out of control. And then secondly, if you could, at least Senator Schumer has talked about the possibility that some people might be put on the no-fly list. Of these 170 case subject files that you've already opened, can you tell us whether you've added any of those people to a no-fly list as a result of what happened?
So we're looking at all different avenues here. So my agents and analysts and all the other FBI personnel in my office and across the country are scrubbing video. We're talking to witnesses. We're talking to individuals that we arrest. And we're gathering that picture, that intelligence, if you will, to understand what happened on the 6th that day in the Capitol, outside the Capitol. We talk to all law enforcement partners. And it's not just the FBI doing this. It's all of our law enforcement partners as well that are working in conjunction with Acting U.S. Attorney's Mike Sherwin's office and our local office here, too, as well. So we're sharing that intelligence amongst each other. We're putting into the intelligence cycle that the FBI has to try to ascertain the true picture of what happened that day. As for the no-fly list, We look at all tools and techniques that we possibly can use within the FBI, and that is something that we are actively looking at.
The next question is from Catherine Herridge from CBS News. Please go ahead.
Thank you for holding this event. The two pipe bombs that were found at the RNC and the DNC, does this cross the threshold to domestic terrorism because they are political targets? And do you think this was designed to either pull first responders away from the scene as the Capitol was breached, or an effort to maim lawmakers as they evacuated?
So I'll try to address that question for you the best I can. So, yes, those two pipe bombs that were found both outside the RNC and the DNC offices near the Capitol grounds. And, look, to begin, they were real devices. They were they had explosive igniters. They had timers. We don't know, obviously, exactly why they did not go off. That's being investigated. They were destroyed, disabled by Capitol Police with the assistance of the ATF. And that is all obviously being vetted and investigated. What was the purpose of those devices being planted? Was it a diversionary type of a tactic used by some of these rioters? Was it something, or did it have some other type of nefarious purpose? So that is what the ATF, the FBI, MPD are looking at as we speak right now, and looking for those persons that planted those devices. In terms of the conduct related to planting those, you know, pipe bombs, the mention of domestic terrorism. I've mentioned this before. I don't like this tyranny of labels saying an act is domestic terrorism. We have plenty of federal resources at our disposal, plenty of federal charges to address all of this conduct, from felony murder related to the possession and use of destructive devices to seditious conspiracy, you know, under the federal code that has significant penalties. And as mentioned, with this strike force that was established to focus strictly on sedition charges, we're looking at and treating this just like a significant international counterterrorism or counterintelligence operation. We're looking at everything: money, travel records, looking at disposition, movement, communication records. So no resource related to the FBI or the U.S. Attorney's Office will be unchecked in terms of trying to determine exactly if there was a command and control, how it operated, and how they executed these activities.
That's Michael Sherwin, the acting U.S. Attorney for you know, the Justice Department. Actually, he's the acting U.S. Attorney for D.C., I'm sorry, and we also had members of the Justice Department. So as the U.S. Attorney for that particular area, he's in charge of filing these charges. And I heard, I can't remember if it was Mr. Sherwin or the other gentleman who was up there for the DOJ, saying that there are extensive videos, and in one of the things I mentioned earlier in the show, and I'm a little confused because I still hear from some people out there that apparently some of you don't think this was that big of a deal. I'm shocked by that, because every day I see videos that are more revolting and sickening, with cops being beaten and dragged. It's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. It really is. And there are people trying to deflect and defend. That's the other thing that's baffling to me, as if it, in some way it's somewhat justified. Or if at every turn you don't mention the behavior of the left over the summer, which was reprehensible. Why do I have to keep repeating? We know that. I covered that during the summer. This was reprehensible, sickening, revolting, what some of these people did. And it wasn't flipping Antifa. Okay? And by the way, one more thing. What happened to the magical speech that President Trump was going to deliver to the cult last night at 8 o'clock, assuring him still a victory? I didn't think that manifested itself. Senator Blunt is coming up next, 2:35 at the Voice of St. Louis.
You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show, sponsored by Cantor Injury Law on KMOX.
Well, coming off some pretty strong messages from the FBI and the Justice Department, the FBI saying we have a long memory and a broad reach just a few minutes ago in this update, and saying we'll be knocking on your door if you were part of criminal activity at the Capitol. It's also interesting that they put a call out, a couple of things. I think there was a warning for people who might be thinking about doing something on Inauguration Day, basically saying, hey, we're going to find you. And then they were asking people to turn themselves in, seemingly offering a better deal if you turn yourself in I don't know how many people are going to do that. We'll see. 2:40. I want to get response this afternoon to Senator Blunt from some of the things that are happening in Washington. We have not had a chance to chat with him since last week. Let me start with what the president said earlier today. Senator, get your reaction.
They've analyzed my speech and my words and my final paragraph, my final sentence, and everybody to the T thought it was totally appropriate.
Senator Roy Blunt with me from Washington this afternoon. How are you, Senator? First and foremost, reaction to those comments from the president this morning, really the first comment since last week for the most part.
Well, I thought the president's Thursday comments were appropriate, and I think he should stick with that Thursday view of what he said and the impact it had. That's all I have to say about it.
You know, I haven't spoken with you about your experience last week. I want to get into some of the issues moving forward. And obviously, you're responsible for putting this inauguration on. But every day I watch more videos that are more horrifying than the day before. And this could have gotten a lot worse than it was, if not for, you know, the actions of a lot of folks there on Capitol Hill and some of the Capitol police officers. When did you realize things were getting pretty dangerous or at least risky for members of the Senate?
Well, I have a lot of faith in the Capitol Police. I was never actually concerned that we were in any danger, even as we were leaving the building. But I did see a couple of police officers take out their actual machine guns. And I thought, well, maybe this is a little more serious than I have thought it was. Because we hadn't seen any of the video. You know, unlike you,
right.
While we were there in the Senate chamber having this debate, you or Abby Blunt or other people are watching the video on the screen, and you see what's happening outside. We really had no idea what was happening outside, and even for a while after we had left the Capitol, we weren't in a place where we could look at anything that was happening. And you know, I do have a lot of responsibility for the building and the architect of the Capitol and the inauguration itself. So I've seen a lot of that video since. It's horrifying. Obviously, the whole event was outrageous and a huge embarrassment for the United States of America. But fortunately, you know, our Capitol Police Force stepped up and did what needed to be done while they were anticipating something else. And, of course, that's a question that the individual officers aren't responsible for. It's why didn't we have National Guard there? Why did it take them 4 hours to get there once we asked for them? And those are the kind of questions we're going to be asking about. I'm not concerned about January the 20th at all, but I am concerned that moving forward we may have to have a different posture at the Capitol now that our adversaries have seen the possibility of what happens if you get in this building. I think, Mark, there may have been 1,000 people in the building. We think there were maybe in the neighborhood of 25,000 people on the Capitol grounds as part of this movement that had moved up from west of the Capitol. And, you know, 25,000 people and there are 1,200 or so Capitol Police stretched out all around the various parts of the building. You get pretty outnumbered pretty quickly. Even if it was 10,000 or 8,000, you know, 8 to 1 is pretty big odds, particularly when they're at one place and you're trying to cover every place. So thank goodness the Capitol Police stepped up. You know, the brutal bludgeoning of Officer Snitsnik, who died, the trauma that some of our officers have experienced over the last 4 or 5 years anyways, it's gotten more and more difficult to be in a police force anywhere. You know, one of the officers I saw almost every day wound up unable to deal with the stress of this. And other officers have come and said, I'm going to leave my weapon here. I'm not sure I should trust myself to have it right now. Yeah. And not to hurt others, but maybe to hurt themselves. So but we need to be sure our officers have all the backup they need. Somebody told me, I went over at the roll call and talked to as many officers as were there for their first roll call at 6:30 Monday morning, House and Senate. And one officer said to me I was visiting with him, he said that was a day where the minutes went like hours and the hours went like minutes. He said, if you're in the thick of it, it seems like it's never going to end. But then at the end of the 9.5 hours of the time he'd been here that day, he said, seemed like to me I'd not been here any time at all. But
yeah.
That's one of those life or death moments. I thought that was a very interesting way to say it. The minutes went like hours, and the hours went like minutes. And if you've ever been in that kind of trauma, I think you'd better understand that than if you hadn't been.
So I saw you on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. Let me get where you are here on the possibility. Obviously, they're talking impeachment in the House and 25th Amendment still out there. Let me play what the president said about that today, about impeachment.
It's really a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in the history of politics. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. This impeachment is causing tremendous anger, and you're doing it, and it's really a terrible thing that they're doing. For Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to continue on this path, I think it's causing tremendous danger to our country, and it's causing tremendous anger. I want no violence. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, he says, I don't want no violence, but obviously they feel like he presents tremendous danger. There are political realities of all this, and there's a clock that's ticking as well. And that's, if I understood your comments on Face the Nation, that's sort of where you're operating in the realm of reality, if you will.
Well, exactly. And frankly, one of the things that the way I look at things is not exactly in line with where everybody is, maybe in the thought process today, because the rational behavior so often just seems to be thrown out the window, as if it doesn't matter if this is possible or not. I'm going to convince people this could happen. And it's virtually impossible to remove the president while he's president. I think it's a terrible way for the Biden administration to get started, to be once continue to focus on the impeachment of a past president, which we have never done before. And it takes time. You know, there's a real question if they do send it over, and they may be able to do that on a partisan vote. If they do send it over, we have to take it up immediately. That would be like January 21 at 1 o'clock, or maybe even January 20 at 1 o'clock. We have to take it up at 1 o'clock, the first day we're fully in session, and it's supposed to be a priority business, which means you can't do anything else until you've dealt with that. I can't imagine that this is really what President-elect Biden wants to see happening, and I think the politics have taken over. I saw on Sunday where they said, well, maybe we'll impeach him now, but we won't send the paperwork over for 100 days.
For 100 days, right. I heard that, yeah.
So clearly the goal here is not to secure the presidency by removing someone that you think should be removed, which I think is what the impeachment process is for, but just to continue a political discussion that has very little to do with the office that that person used to hold, because they're not there anymore, by the way, and may not have been for months if, in fact, the whip of the House, Jim Clyburn's view of how they might deal with this is right. So it's, we've gone way beyond the implications of securing the country to the pure politics of this, and I think it's very bad politics for them. You know, I think one of the best things Republicans ever have going for us is that the Democrats always overreach. And I can't imagine a bigger overreach at the start of the Biden administration than reaching back and impeaching the past president who's no longer in office and can't be removed because he's not there. But that, you know, they're going to have to decide that, and we'll see what happens.
Well, that kind of leads me into one more question here. Senator Roy Blunt, moving forward, let's get past next week and working with President Biden. Your expectations, because one of the things that the president said as we started this segment, you know, he feels like there are people who are angry, and they are. There are people, Trump supporters, who were not rioting last week, that are worried about the future of the country. They're worried about a lurch left by AOC and the squad and Cori Bush here in Missouri, but also by Joe Biden. So what are your expectations moving forward here to the first 100 days?
Well, I think we'll have to see how Democrats in the Senate handle their newfound power. I think if we could have stayed focused on the issues rather than the November election, we could have won one or two of those Georgia seats, maybe both of those Georgia seats. That would be a much more balanced environment where you have to talk to others. That's not going to be the balance here. The balance here is going to be incredibly narrow, but Democrats control everything. And we'll see. The president-elect says he wants to bring people together. That will be constant conflict with trying to control everything and do whatever your side by the narrowest of margins wants to do, and we will see what happens there. I can't imagine that that's the way President Biden wants to start out, but his party leaders may insist that they start out that way.
Senator Roy Blunt, always great to have you on.
Hey,
crazy week.
Great to talk to you.
We'll see how things shake out moving forward. Thanks, Roy. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
251. I love the way that, and look, sometimes I don't follow up with Senator Blunt because I know what the answer is going to be, and he made it very clear. The first question was, what do you think of what the president said today? And he basically said, well, I wish he would have said what he said last week, and I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not saying anymore. It's 251. We're back with more in a moment on KMOX. There's a guy in Boston who owns a place called the Breakfast Club Diner, George Athensopoulos. I'm going to go with that. Greek, I'm guessing, there. And he put up an informational sign for the people coming into the restaurant. And health inspectors came because there were complaints that were lodged by Jess Shaw, who has been a guest many times on this program. Now, he was a guest last week. He writes about this, and a couple of Karens lodged a complaint. They found everyone in the place wearing masks, both the staff and the patrons, and there weren't even that many people to check because in that particular city, this is in Boston again, you know, 25% capacity, which I think is where we're at right now. I actually was joking with a friend of mine who is from St. Louis. He's in Cleveland. He's a restaurant guy last night, and just because, you know, you say things like this every once in a while, and he was saying he wants to retire in 10 years. He's my age. I said, I'm trying for 5 years, and you just don't know what the radio business is going to hold. And I said, hey, you got any jobs in the restaurant business? And he said, no. The governors of the country have essentially ensured that there's little to no restaurant work available. So that's not going to happen. But anyway, the guy posts this sign, and people complain about it, but here's the nuance to it. There's a little loophole, and when you think about it, it's kind of dumb. The sign explains that people with an underlying health condition that would make it problematic to wear a mask are exempt under the rules. So he was suggesting that that's certainly something you can consider, and it's also not even legal, by the way, for Athensopoulos or his staff to ask customers the details of their personal health condition. So in other words, if you're wearing a mask or if you're not wearing a mask, you go in the restaurant, you're not wearing a mask, the restaurant employee's not going to ask you anyway because they can't ask you if you have a health condition. You can say you have a health condition. Now, none of this is to tell people not to wear masks when they're supposed to wear masks. It's to kind of underscore the lunacy of some of this stuff. So one of the questions that comes to mind is, you're supposed to wear a mask except when eating or drinking, but this is a diner, right? I went to Fleming's over the weekend, went out to dinner on Saturday night. I was so excited because I had Sam Page's address and his phone number, and I was going to have the whole group sign into Sam Page, and they didn't make us do that, which I thought was unusual. I don't know if they're just ignoring it or if it was just something that the county has decided not to follow up on, but man, I was all prepared for that. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get into the second hour of the show coming up here. I started a new video feature for the beginning of the year. I'm going to give a little sample of that coming up after the top of the hour. 50 years ago today was the first episode of All in the Family. Pretty culturally significant. Robert Thompson, who teaches television and pop culture at Syracuse University, is going to join me. And also, the crisis no one is talking about. Kind of half joking, but there's an aluminum can shortage out there, and we'll talk about it with John Daly at 3:35 this afternoon. Total Information PM at 4. The news with Carol is coming up next on KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.